Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Happy New Year. It is the first day of 2019, which means new laws are going into effect. In Connecticut and Hawaii, employers can no longer ask job applicants about pay history, so they can't lowball workers. In California, pets are now part of the family. A judge can award custody in a divorce. What else is going on in the Golden State? Well, Ben Adler is Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Ben, Happy New Year.
And same to you, Robin.
Yep. And in California, you're starting it off with these laws. But remind us why we should care in other states if California has new laws today.
Well, the saying goes, as goes California, so goes the rest of the nation. And I think I would amend that slightly here to say, as goes California, so go blue states, states with Democrats in control, because California has a full-time legislature, more than 2,000 people on the legislative staff, and hordes of interest groups that help craft legislation. And so what comes out of the state house here often serves as a template for states wishing to pursue similar issues and similar laws elsewhere.
Well, it's amazing how many there are. They range from requiring body camera footage from police be released within 45 days of a police shooting to a requirement that all dogs, cats, and rabbits sold in California pet stores have to come from animal shelters or rescue groups to, if you want a straw in a restaurant, you have to ask for it. It can't just be given out because of the huge concern about how much pollution straws cause. So there's just so much. Let's get started. And let's start with public safety. You know, we see police shootings and outcry from the public. Talk about these new laws about police transparency.
And these are laws that have failed to pass the legislature in previous years, but got fresh momentum from the shooting that listeners may recall of Stephon Clark here in Sacramento last spring. But two measures in particular to highlight: one that allows public access to police records and use of force cases, as well as investigations that confirmed on-the-job dishonesty or sexual misconduct. And I think that goes back for several years of records. And you've got journalists and activists throughout the state poised over their keyboard to hit send on those public records requests today or maybe tomorrow when businesses open. And then also a measure requiring that body camera footage be released within 45 days of a police shooting or when an officer's use of force causes death or great bodily harm. So you've got records and body camera footage, written records and video footage that are going to be a lot more accessible to the public. And law enforcement agencies are going to have to adapt.
Okay, well, there's that. California also has new laws, and a lot of these laws are off the news, as you've said. They have new laws as a result of the Me Too movement. Talk about these new laws.
Sure. And the Me Too movement had a big effect at the California state capitol, as several lawmakers have been forced out of office due to allegations. And the legislature itself actually had to come up with a whole new system to handle investigations of lawmakers. But these laws that are taking effect apply much more broadly, although also to the legislature. So, for example, non-disclosure agreements, that's where you sign away your right to talk about the fact that you even had a settlement in the first place. Well, they're going to be banned in sexual harassment, assault, and discrimination cases signed on or after today. Mm-hmm. Then you've got an issue of non-disparagement agreements. Those are basically where you sign away your right to complain about your company. And so I guess there's been this practice of making it standard for new employees or employees getting raises to sign non-disparagement agreements and even waive their rights to file legal claims. And that's going to be prohibited as a general practice. But you could still sign away those two particular rights in exchange for a severance package if you leave a company.
Right. But that, I mean, there's an illustration of how, you know, other states are watching this, because tons of companies have these, you know, non-disparagement and non-disclosure agreements.
And it's going to be interesting to see whether this just stays in California or whether, again, these bills, this language, get adopted by other states. And once it gets to the point where many other states are subject to these laws, then you might see nationwide companies making the change just to standardize their procedures. And so that, again, is a key example of how California, with its market share being such a big state, can cause large companies to change their practices just by passing its own laws.
Right. Staying with the Me Too movement and gender, you have a new law there allowing Californians to identify themselves as non-binary, meaning they're not this or that.
So this is actually a law that took effect at the start of last year, but there's a key piece of it phasing in right now, and that is that the DMV, its driver's license application form will require applicants to choose either male, female, or non-binary. And there are other state documents that are working on this as well that previously have taken effect or will take effect in the future. But this is key because it's going to be self-selected. So that means any Californian on their driver's license can choose what their gender is. So it's you know, one of the many laws that California has pushed to expand LGBT rights, and it's one that is going to be noticeable by Californians no matter what their gender.
Okay, there's that. Senate Bill 1192 limits restaurants from serving sugary drinks to kids as like the default. This is so great. You know, you can ask for a soda for a little kid, but restaurants have to make water or milk the default.
Yeah, it's response to the question of, well, do we want our kids to have the default option of being, you know, a sugary drink, or do we want to make the default milk or water? This gets to the question of what is the right role of government, and there are plenty of critics in California who will decry a law like this as, you know, nanny state government.
Yeah.
And the response from Democrats running the state is, look, you know, we want to encourage kids to make healthy choices.
Okay, and staying with food, cities and counties can now permit the sale of meals made in home kitchens. Look, I'm all for, you know, people, you know, being able to sell their cookies at a bake sale, whatever, but this sounds like it's more commercial. Aren't there concerns about inspections and health considerations?
I think so. It's also a growing industry, right, where individuals can choose to – I mean, it's what? The Lyft or Uber of preparing food for people. You take this concept and then you boil it down to the one-on-one transaction level, but you have a centralized company that is kind of serving as the marketplace. You know, Lyft, Uber, Airbnb are examples in other industries. And I think this is something that now local governments are going to need to figure out the best way to go about, is how do you permit and how do you regulate this to ensure that everything is safe.
Yeah.
And then you'd mentioned the drinks for Happy Meals, but there's also the straws bill, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of what you'd have to request at full service restaurants, you're going to need to request a single-use plastic straw. Otherwise, you'll just get a cup, you know, and you can sip from it.
Well, and as you request that single-use, one-time-only plastic straw, the entire rest of the restaurant will shame you because we know how harmful they've been.
The spotlight will come down from above.
Right.
And it'll just be focused on you.
Listen, I want to talk about some of the serious things having to do with gun control, DUI deterrence, juvenile justice. There's a law prohibiting 14 and 15-year-old defendants from being prosecuted as adults. Gun control. I didn't realize that. I think this has to do with the laws allowing people to call a flag on someone they fear might use a gun.
Gun violence restraining orders have gotten a lot of attention.
Right.
And not just in blue states, my understanding is, too. I think there may have been a debate in Florida.
But there's a new law that would eliminate the fees for requesting these restraining orders. I didn't realize people had to pay to say that they were afraid that a relative was, you know, considering suicide and could you please take the gun?
Well, I think it's just anytime there's a court procedure. I mean, courts have to support themselves. And if you're creating a new process and there are new cases coming under a judge's purview, then, you know, there's going to be a cost associated with it. And I think this is a case of the state stepping in and saying, well, in this case, courts are going to have to find the money for it some other way. We want to make sure that this does not cost someone money when they're filing a gun violence restraining order request.
Because we're already hearing from the police that they're more likely to file these restraining orders. The families are still, you know, kind of frightened to do it. So this maybe eases that a little bit. Also, it allows police to confiscate ammunition as well as guns. DUI deterrence. There's a pilot program, I guess, in California that mandates those ignition interlock devices for people who are repeat offenders. It's going to be spread through the state.
Yeah, so this is a case where, you know, if you're an ignition interlock device is when you get into your car, you need to blow into it and establish that you have not been drinking in order for your car to start. Then periodically while you're driving, it can come on randomly and have you blow again. So this has been something that several counties have started using, and now it's going to be expanding statewide for severe or repeat drunk driving convictions. So it's just another effort of DUI deterrence that California is taking on.
And Ben, one last question. So new laws, lots of change, new year. New leadership, Jerry Brown being replaced by Gavin Newsom as governor there in California. Just some thoughts. That's a real changing of the guard. Jerry Brown, the son of a governor, stepping down.
And someone who is both California's youngest, oldest, and longest serving governor, two terms in the 70s and 80s, two more starting in 2011. He came into the governor's office in 2011 with California facing a $27 billion budget deficit. The surplus he will hand over to Gavin Newsom is projected to be nearly that big. Brown also benefited from the economy soaring, and it remains to be seen whether Newsom will have that as well. But we do expect Newsom to govern somewhat more to the left of Jerry Brown, and he will have a much more Democratic legislature, if that's possible, because Democrats already had large majorities. But the big gains California Democrats made at the congressional level trickled down to state legislative races. And so we talk about the laws that we just rattled through. Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say there will be a whole new set of these laws a year from now that might be well worth additional conversation.
Ben Adler, Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio in Sacramento as a new day dawns. Ben, thank you.
You're welcome.
Maybe you've heard this music before in comedies. It's from a classical ballet called Sylvia by a French Romantic era composer named Leo Delibes, and it was a huge inspiration to a Russian about the same age as Delibes who composed some of the greatest ballet music ever, including Sleeping Beauty. See what he did there? Took some of that pizzicato from Delibes. And our classical music opinionator, Fran Hoffner, writes that without Leo Delibes, there'd be no Tchaikovsky. And when we asked Fran what she wanted to start the new year with, she said Delibes and Tchaikovsky. Fran, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You're there at WBEZ in Chicago.
Yes, home for the holidays.
Home for the holidays. Good for you. Well, this is a big claim. No Tchaikovsky without Leo Delibes?
Yeah, I really do believe it.
Well, he said as much. Tchaikovsky wrote to friends. What did he say about Delibes' music?
He said that it was the first time in a ballet that the music itself was sort of the main interest, the spectacle.
And coming from him, of course, that's something. Let's listen to the very beginning of Sylvia. And you say right there with those the cymbals crashing, this is a very opening. It feels as if Sylvia is welcoming you inside. Inside what? What's the story?
The story is somewhat incoherent, but it's a little bit of a classic boy meets girl. Girl maybe orchestrates her own kidnapping, is kidnapped, and he has to save her. But there are a lot of twists and turns, and I think part of the reason why the music is the spectacle of Sylvia is maybe because the story of Sylvia is a little difficult to follow.
Well, but and what is it about the music that makes it so to you compelling?
I think it's fairly, I'm thinking simple, but I don't mean that it sounds easy. There is a lot of elements of folk music in it, so I think it sort of elevated this really common, known type of music in France and made it this high art that sort of could like bring in the masses to appreciate it.
Let's listen to Cortège Rustique, which is a rustic parade. You wrote that you don't even mind the tambourine.
No. typically annoyed, but really love how it's working here.
Yeah. And there's something, as you write, that's hummable about this music.
Yeah, it's the kind of melody you can really take home with you.
Let's listen to the Dance of the Priestess. There's this mysterious oboe solo. Let's listen.
Yeah.
Thank you. you can't hear this from Dalib Sylvia and not be thinking about Tchaikovsky. Here's the Nutcracker. But you hear it.
Yeah.
Homage, perhaps?
Yeah, they both have this really seductive kind of feminine energy.
Yeah.
I think that's so, it feels very magical.
Well, and we're talking about ballet music here.
Mm-hmm.
Do we even know the ballet for Sylvia?
I'm not very familiar
and
with
it. And that's the point. It's more that you are caring about this music, and that's what Tchaikovsky said in praising it.
I feel like in listening to it, I don't have to have seen it. I can just love it when it's on, and I'm just living my life.
The priestess dance, you say, all but cartwheels into mm-hmm. Sylvia's re-entrance. Let's listen. Even here you say there's something a little nutcrackery about
Definitely.
It.
Well, there's this really strong exuberance to it. And, you know, I don't know the story of Sylvia very well. And yet I still feel this, you know, this emotional return of this character, despite not having any frame of reference for her.
Right. Talk about Tchaikovsky's greatest heroine, Sleeping Beauty, Princess Aurora, as she's known in the ballet. Here's some music from the Rose Adagio, where she's partnered one after the other with several princes who want to marry her. Very difficult for the ballerina, who has to hold her balance on toes throughout. Let's listen. God.
Yeah. And so that's all spectacle.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
sort of the takeaway from Dalib.
Okay, a couple questions. First of all, we know this is the story of Aurora, who's cursed at her birth, that when she turns 16, she's going to prick her finger and die. But the lilac fairy comes and says, no, let's just make it she'll sleep for 100 years. I always wondered if she knew she was going to prick her finger at 16, why no gloves?
Yeah.
The whole time. So that
it's
would never happen.
Question.
But there you go. Mm-hmm. And then she's awakened. We know that in 1888, the director of the Imperial Theater in Moscow told Tchaikovsky he's going to write this plot based on, you know, Grimm Brothers' fairy tale version of a French story. He, Tchaikovsky, loved the story. Tell us more about his writing it and what this music meant to him.
He really blew through the writing of this. I think he said he did it in 40 days. You can feel that sort of rushed passion to it. Mm-hmm. It really has that energy to it. And I think Tchaikovsky was also looking for maybe something of a comeback after Swan Lake, which was not so warmly received at the time. And this is, I think, a much more populist ballet, to use such a commonly known sort of fairy tale.
So Swan Lake didn't go so well, and now he writes Sleeping Beauty. One of your favorite passages is the Garland Waltz. Let's listen. Of course, Fran, dance fans are picturing this Garland waltz with the dancers, but you're just loving it for the music. It was used in the 1959 Disney film of Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah.
Let's listen.
I know you. I walked with you once upon a dream. I know you. The tear in your eyes is so familiar.
Yeah, I've always been so partial to that, to the Disney adaptation of Sleeping Beauty. I think it's like one of the most beautiful animated Disney films.
Oh, boy. Defend that, because you know classicists are going to be in uproar.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Seeing it on film also, I think it's just one of the most dazzling movies. But, you know, you see a lot of classical music adapted into film scores all the time. And this was one where I knew the Disney song first and then just so happened to be listening to the Sleeping Beauty ballet and never put two and two together that this waltz was essentially adapted into one of probably the most famous song from that movie.
Yeah, beautiful. I want to go back to where we started, the pizzicato from Sylvia, which I thought, oh, I didn't even know I knew Sylvia. And there's that piece. Let's listen to it. That becomes such a joke.
I don't know. Pizzicato has really endured as a comedic scoring, perhaps because it feels so light and easy.
Well, this is used by the Marx Brothers. You can just see them, you know. And I also picture, you know, large ungainly men dancing to it.
Sure, yeah.
But it's from a piece you highly recommend.
It is. It has that, you know, simplistic spectacle of the music that you don't have to know the story or even have an image conjured in your mind to appreciate sort of what Daylieb is doing.
That's Fran Hoffner. She writes about classical music for WQXR in New York. Fran, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Imagine getting a phone call from a nameless stranger who claims to have kidnapped your loved one and is demanding a ransom. This happened to a Texas family last fall, but it's a scam, and it's spreading across the country. Paul Flav of Texas Public Radio reports.
It was a Sunday in early November. Hannah Stone attended church, had breakfast with her two kids, then dropped off her 14-year-old daughter, Lauren, at an ice cream store to wait for a couple of friends.
And saw her walk right towards the building. It wasn't but, 10, 15 feet?
Stone hadn't driven two blocks when her phone rang. It was a strange number, but she knew her daughter's cell phone wasn't charged, so she picked it up.
When I answered the phone, I heard kind of a gasp and crying, and what sounded like my daughter, Lauren, saying, "Mom," terrified. And I said, "Baby, what's wrong?" Then a man grabbed the phone from her and said, "We have your daughter."
The man said they were Mexican mafia and that he wanted $5,000 to get her daughter back. Stunned, she pulled the car over. The next hour was hell, she says, as the man told her to stay on the phone and talk to no one while he coached her through wiring money to multiple accounts.
They told me when I go in, put the phone by my side, that I better act calm, that I was being observed.
What she didn't know was that her daughter wasn't in any danger. The whole thing was a scam, what authorities call a virtual kidnapping. It's been around for more than 10 years, and parents and authorities are reporting it's happening around the country with increasing frequency.
Sounded like my son was on the other end saying, "Mom, Mom, help me."
Someone had my son, who I had heard crying and screaming in the background.
"You need to stay on this phone, do not hang up, or your daughter's dead."
FBI Special Agent Michelle Lee says the scammer's goal is to keep people in a state of shock.
In many cases, they have a lot of actors. They'll have, you know, children or young women screaming, and they are very authentic.
The FBI doesn't have exact numbers, says Lee, because parents go to local police and the crime gets lumped in with other fraud schemes. Even more underreported because people are embarrassed when they find out it's a scam. 4 years ago, the FBI became aware of criminals targeting doctors in South Texas. Now they target high-income zip codes like Fredericksburg, where Hannah Stone lives. But Lee says the scammers aren't that sophisticated.
Most of the schemes that we have seen, they're focused on volume. They're wanting to make as many phone calls as quickly as possible, hoping to find a victim.
Joseph Steinberg is a cybersecurity expert. He says the culture of oversharing on the internet has fed this issue.
The advent of social media has made it very easy for criminals to know when people are not reachable.
Steinberg says there are a number of things you can do to avoid scammers. He suggests limiting the amount of travel details you share online, and he says screen your calls.
There's really almost no reason to answer your phone if you don't recognize the number. The person either is going to text you or leave you a voicemail.
Still, FBI agent Lee says the scams are hard to combat because many of them originate in other countries, including from Mexican prisons. In fact, the only person to be convicted for the crime was in September of this year, and that was only because criminals in Mexico were limited to how much money they could wire transfer. A 35-year-old Houston woman was sentenced to 7 years for picking up physical money drops. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
Student survivors of the Parkland school shooting, in which 17 people were killed, are responding to comedian Louis C.K.'s not-at-all-funny comments over the weekend, including that they only survived because they pushed a fat kid in the way. Alea Eastman tweeted out a reference to C.K.'s sexual misconduct. "Since you like making fun of us behind closed doors, I'm right here if you want to talk. Just try to keep it in your pants, okay?" But the survivors undoubtedly have more important things on their minds right now. The South Florida Sun-Sentinel has published a devastating, detailed timeline of the 58 minutes of chaos at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, concluding that children and teachers died because the Broward County Sheriff's Office and the school district failed them. Now, warning, this is grim stuff, and we'll post the report and all the embedded security camera footage at hereandnow.org. As we welcome Stephen Hobbs, one of the reporters. And Stephen, we knew, for instance, one armed deputy, Peterson, didn't call in a lockdown, didn't go in the school. But were you surprised at how many failures there were, other deputies arriving, not one, running towards the shooting?
We were, Robin. We had heard some talk after the shooting, one about Scott Peterson, as you mentioned, the school resource deputy, not immediately rushing in. And we had also heard some talk that there were some other deputies who didn't immediately rush in, but we didn't really have an idea that it would be a total of 8 deputies, including Peterson, that arrived at the school in time to hear gunfire and did not immediately rush in. No. Now, one just important piece of note, Peterson really is the only deputy who was there while people were getting shot. But still, while there was gunfire and deputies maybe should have been tipped off to that there was an active shooter situation at the school, those deputies did not immediately rush in.
Well, it may have had to do with a recent change in policy.
The sheriff had changed the policy to deputies may go into an active shooter situation immediately versus what it previously was with that they shall go in. He didn't want deputies to go, what he said, like a suicide mission, immediately go in a situation that could be an issue for officer safety. Yeah. But this was a policy that was criticized very much and actually changed in light of what happened at the school.
Well, it's been the thinking since Columbine, when police officers also stayed outside the school, that immediately go towards the shooter and take the shooter out. And in fact, neighboring police came from Coral Springs, and they all immediately ran in and said that.
Some of it was that maybe Coral Springs had some more information. There's a little bit of a confusing thing about where the 911 calls were going, but they still immediately went in, and even officers from other departments who were maybe off duty or from a different department came in, and they were much more quick to try to go towards the building even well after the shooting, but they still knew that people needed to be there to try to find out where the shooter was.
Well, and you quote one of them saying, this is what we learned in active shooting drills, and people from Broward County couldn't remember the most recent drill. So that was a cautionary note there. But let's start at the beginning of this horrible afternoon. An unarmed security monitor, Andrew Medina, a coach at the school, is riding in a golf cart. He's unlocking gates. This is before class is dismissed. He sees Nicholas Cruz with a rifle bag. He even has a name for him. But right there, he has a radio. He doesn't call in a lockdown. What does he do?
He kind of watches Cruz go into the building, and he radios ahead to one of his colleagues, another, they're called campus monitors, and he kind of stops and doesn't pursue Cruz once he goes into the building because it was, you know, he said that he radioed ahead.
Yeah.
But yes, as you mentioned, this was an opportunity, one, to call a lockdown, or two, you know, actively pursue Cruz in his golf cart and try to get to him very quickly, which, you know, once again, we don't know, but potentially may have been a way to stop the shooting before it happened.
The name that this Andrew Medina had for this student was Crazy Boy. So obviously he knew that there was this young man had some issues. The man that he called inside is David Taylor. David Taylor, inside, you have the security video. He sees Nicholas Cruz, turns around and goes the other way. That's chilling to see.
Yes. Now, he told investigators what he was trying to do was Nicholas Cruz went into the building and turned into a stairwell. He later said that he turned around to go up the stairwell to try to head him off. But still, yeah, once again, we're kind of left with wondering maybe if he would have continued. We don't know what could have happened, but maybe this was another opportunity for the shooting to have been stopped. And once he started going up the stairs to, as he said, head off Cruz, he heard some sounds. And that was another opportunity to maybe call a code red if it to him sounded like gunfire. And I should explain, code red is a kind of a school lockdown, an opportunity to have people stay in their classrooms. Because as we see, that became an issue later in the shooting.
Instead, Dave Taylor goes and hides in a closet. And it does become an issue because the shooting sets off the fire alarms. And young people do what they do in a fire alarm. They stream into the halls instead of if what had come out over the PA was code red, they would have stayed in their classrooms. So the carnage, I mean, they're in the halls. And then you come across problems like on the first floor, Nicholas Cruz is just shooting through the windows of classrooms. And many of the classrooms don't have what's called hard corners, places where people can hide out of sight of the window. And that had been recommended. By the time he gets to the third floor and some of these students are trapped in the hall because some of the doors have locked behind the teachers who came out for the fire drill, they try to get into the bathrooms. The bathrooms are locked because kids were vaping and there was concerns about that. And then, you know, the word you choose is chaos. That seems accurate because there doesn't seem to be, going back to the responding Broward County deputies, no one's in charge.
Yeah, there was really an opportunity that was noted just in our reporting and other reporting on this issue for people to take control early on and just be able to have a better organization of the response. And there were a lot of issues that played into that chaos as well. There was a real issue with the surveillance video. One of the things that happened was a couple administrators or school officials went inside the room to look at footage. And it's a little bit unclear just based on our reporting, but at some point they were relaying information to other school officials and police trying to track Nicholas Cruz inside the building.
Yeah.
There became a delay in what they were looking at. They were saying at points he's moving from the second to the third floor. And so officers inside the building thought that the shooter was still in there when in fact he had left more than 20 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
And so it's a little bit unclear whether or not the people in the school's camera room knew that the video was, you know, behind and they were looking at old footage or if they thought it was live. But still, the result is that cops thought it was live at some point and they were preparing to have a kind of a shootout with the shooter in that building.
Look, you have tons of sound and video in your piece. We're not going to play it now because it's just, you know, it'll trigger some people. It's just terrible. But we want to point out there were heroics as well. A teacher who holds a stairwell door closed against the shooter. Athletic director Chris Hickson, who ran toward Cruz and was shot and killed. But what are you hearing from Broward County about this devastating indictment of the not just the police response, But the school, which had been told by investigators to do certain things like, you know, make hard corners in the room so a shooter can't see students, that kind of thing. What are you hearing back after this?
Well, I think what this shooting has really shown, not just even in our county, but statewide, is there's a real push to try to make sure something like this doesn't happen again. Locally, people are asking for leadership changes to the sheriff's office and the school district, but even just more specifically, people are asking for policy changes, making sure that lockdown information is more clear, that the hard corners, as you mentioned, those kind of safe areas in classrooms are more pronounced, that there's better training with the police agencies as well as the schools. But statewide, there's been a real big focus. It's unfortunately a reality that many places may have to deal with because you don't really know what could happen. So I think a lot of places in the state are looking at this for an opportunity to try to update their policies and procedures for a potential next shooting.
Stephen Hobbs of the South Florida Sun Sentinel, part of the team that reported on the timeline of what happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th of last year. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we want to end this hour with a story that may be off your radar, but it's fascinating. In raucous makeshift churches in Turkey, some Iranians who've fled their country are converting to Christianity. Now, converting is prohibited for Muslims in Iran, but in Turkey, there's more religious freedom. Some of the migrants are converting out of faith. Others are hoping it will help them get into the U.S. or Europe. Reporter Fariba Nawa has our story.
In this hotel conference room in Turkey, about 60 Iranians sing along to songs praising Jesus mixed with Iranian pop music. The American pastor, Rick Robinson, preaches in English, and an Iranian woman who's converted to Christianity translates in Farsi.
Our people in free countries, but without God, they do not have hope and peace. Here we are.
Ma اینجا هستیم.
In the presence of God.
در حضور خداوند.
And we have peace.
و ما آرامش داریم اینجا.
These Iranians are part of a larger movement of Muslims converting to Christianity in Iran, then fleeing to seek the religious freedom that Turkey allows by law. Churches like this are popping up in many small Anatolian cities where the Turkish government settles refugees. Among the parishioners is Farzana. She didn't want to give her last name because her family in Iran could be persecuted for her conversion. The 37-year-old says the Islam practiced in Iran discriminates against women.
Mostly because of this, I became disillusioned with Islam.
When Farzana divorced her first husband in Iran, she lost custody of her two children.
That judge sitting there and giving orders was completely siding with men. Everywhere in Iran, men come before women.
A year later, Farzana remarried her current husband and had another daughter who's three. Then she converted to Christianity, but had to practice in secret home churches in Tehran and endure harassment from authorities. She paid a smuggler to get her family to Turkey. They settled in Denizli, Farzana got a job at a Turkish beauty salon, and found this Pentecostal church.
I'm not famous or rich, but I know Jesus.
Yes.
I have Jesus.
That's Pastor Carl Vickery. Vickery puts his hand on one woman's head and speaks in tongues. Women with hair dyed blonde and short skirts and clean-shaven men in slacks stand up to pray. People are sweating. Farzana's among them.
It feels good. Our relationship to God becomes closer.
Shebnem Kosher Akçapar, a professor at Istanbul's Koç University, has been studying refugees and their changing of faith.
The numbers of Iranian refugees in Turkey converting to evangelism have grown tremendously over the years.
Akçapar says some of the refugees are genuine converts, and some are converting in hopes that it'll make it easier for them to get to the West. So far this year, the U.S. and European countries have opened doors to a small fraction of Christian refugees. In the U.S., it's become more difficult under the Trump administration. Pastor Robinson's church welcomes anyone, whether they're genuinely converting or not.
I would say somewhere between a third and a half are sincere. There might even be some who start just for the help with the refugee status and become sincere.
Robinson supports Trump's refugee policy. He says Iranians should stay in Turkey if they can support themselves.
I can tell you what I tell a lot of our people here. If you can make a life here in this country, and it's not a bad country, the chances of you seeing your family every year are almost guaranteed.
Yet the Iranian refugees face discrimination in hiring and are sometimes harassed, especially the converts. The Pentecostal church keeps the location of its services secret. And when it comes time to baptize, the church goes to a Turkish bathhouse. The baptism is proof for their asylum case. On a recent Friday, the pastors enter a swimming pool inside the bathhouse and help each parishioner in colorful robes dunk their head under the water.
We now baptize you in Jesus' name for the remission of sins.
Sabah Alavardi, a 22-year-old university student, converted in Iran and moved to Turkey 6 months ago.
I never thought this would happen to me in Iran, but now I'm really happy because my life is changing.
The baptized Iranians exit the pool beaming and dripping wet. They'll receive a certificate that documents their change of faith with the hope that they can live in a country with freedom and acceptance. For NPR News, I'm Fariba Nawah in Denizli, Turkey.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, and our noble crew, our directors, Mark Navin and Alex Ashlock, producers, James Perkins, Lynn Menegon, Emiko Tamagawa, Jill Ryan, Eileen Valinsky, Karen Miller-Medson, Chris Bentley, Ashley Bailey, Julia Corcoran, Marcel Hutchins, Savannah Marr, and Cassidy Rosenblum, our web team, the Jacksons, Mitchell and Cote, and Samantha Rafelson, our technical directors, James Trout, Mike Moschetto, with help from Max Liebman, our senior managing editor, Todd Munt, our managing editor, Chris Ballman, Peter O'Dowd is senior editor, Kathleen McKenna is the boss of all. And from all of us, thanks for listening in the old year. We wish you only happiness in the new one, here and now.